19.2 meter band.
Today is Friday, November 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Ruofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. expresses concern over human rights abuses in the Ethiopian Tigray conflict.
For a year now, we have expressed grave concern over the horrific violence committed against civilians during the conflict in northern Ethiopia.
South Korean president calls for a declaration to end a state of war with the North since the 1950s.
South and North Korea are technically still at war, even though the fighting ended six decades ago.
And schools in 13 African countries to boost digital learning for millions of children. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ethiopia's government has marked a year of war by lashing out against international alarm about hate speech. This as Facebook says it has removed a post by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed that urged citizens to rise up and, quote, bury, unquote, rival Tigray forces who now threaten the capital. The U.S. says it is, quote, carefully reviewing, unquote, a joint investigation by the United Nations and Ethiopia that accuses all sides of the conflict in Tigray of torturing and killing civilians, carrying out gang rapes and making arrests on the basis of ethnicity. State Department spokesman Ned Price called the report published on Wednesday, quote, a sobering account of serious human rights abuses and violations by all parties to the conflict, unquote.
We are carefully reviewing the report. We appreciate the fact that it sets forth a sobering account of extensive, serious human rights abuses and violations committed by all parties to the conflict. For a year now, we have expressed grave concern over the horrific violence committed against civilians during the conflict in northern Ethiopia by all parties. And that includes egregious acts such as killings, sexual and gender-based violence, abductions, and other human rights abuses.
That's State Department spokesman Ned Price. U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, is in Ethiopia Friday. This after rebel forces from the northern Tigray region said they were moving towards the capital and the government in Addis Ababa declared a state of emergency. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane reports.
On Thursday, Ethiopia marks the one-year anniversary of brutal fighting between government forces aligned with Eritrean forces and rebels in the northern Tigray region. Now, rebel forces say they are advancing on the capital, Addis Ababa, and that it could fall within months or even weeks. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed vowed that his government will prevail.
Ethiopia will not collapse. Ethiopia will prosper. Ethiopia will forever exist with her honor by defeating all who test her throughout the blood and bones of her children.
As residents of the capital read in their newspapers, the Ethiopian government declared a state of emergency and called on residents to defend their neighborhood if rebels arrive in the capital. The president of the Tigray region, Debretsion Gebremichael, blamed the Ethiopian government and their allies for the suffering.
The warmongers decided to continue with the war, and we entered into this war because the only option we had is to destroy our enemies by force.
State Department spokesperson Ned Price called on all the warring parties to end the fighting and protect the lives and rights of citizens. He said the State Department has now updated the travel advisory for Ethiopia to level 4.
What that means is we are advising U.S. citizens do not travel to Ethiopia. We are recommending that U.S. citizens in Ethiopia consider departing now using commercial options that remain available.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, said the year-long conflict was marked by extreme brutality.
We have reasonable grounds to believe that during this period, all parties to the Tigray conflict have committed violations of international human rights, humanitarian, and refugee law. Some of these may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Civilians in Tigray have been subjected to brutal violence and suffering.
A report by the UN Human Rights Office with the government-created Ethiopian Human Rights Commission found that sexual violence has been rampant in the conflict, detailing reports of gang rapes by various parties against women and girls, but also against men and boys. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A former university professor and historian specializing in the Horn of Africa says the Tigray military advance towards Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, could mark the end of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government. Professor Gerard Prunier says the Ethiopian military has disintegrated and that placed it in the hands of rebels who are well armed. Prunier says the current shuttle diplomacy in Addis Ababa by Jeffrey Feltman, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, will not stop the rebels from advancing on the capital of Ethiopia. Prunier spoke with John Tanza, the managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program. They start by discussing the role of Oromo forces in the war, which began a year ago.
Well, first of all, it's a little bit more complicated than what you say. It is not the Oromo Liberation Front, which is a political organization and doesn't have an army. It is the Oromo Liberation Army, OLA, which has seceded from the OLF. They are a fighting force. They are a military outfit. Now, are they centralized? Are they well organized? The answer is no. The Oromos are the largest minority in the country, the largest group, about 38 million people, which is not quite a tribe, it's a people. There are many countries that doesn't have 38 million population. But these Oromo are not very well organized, and they are not very centralized. So the solution for the TDF would be to say, we have now, we can occupy Addis, but we don't. We don't do again what we did in 1991, which led to a dead end. Instead, we ask the Oromos to take Addis and change the government, and we will join in a broad conference to decide what can be done. The problem is that the Oromos are not very unified. So it is very difficult for the Tigrayans to say, okay, we are very careful, we don't rush things, we don't take Addis, we let the Oromos, whose country it is, because Addis Ababa, they don't even call it Addis Ababa, they call it Finfine, which is the Oromo name. They can take it because this is their country, and we are going to respect their presence and then negotiate with them. The negotiation is not between the rebels. Abiy is a wasted case. Negotiation would be between the Oromos and the Tigrayans. The problem is which Oromos? That the OLF and the OLA were not the same thing. But even within the OLA is not a unified organization. It is more like a federation of, say, regional militias. So this is a very difficult question for the Tigrayans. What would they do if and when they win the war?
Talk to me about the shuttle diplomacy. The U.S. special envoy for the Horn of Africa is in Addis Ababa. President Uhuru Kenyatta has talked about the need for dialogue. Talk to me about the dynamics of this shuttle diplomacy.
It's actually very dry, and it's unlikely that it serves any purpose for the time being. Once the shooting stops, yes, perhaps. But right now, both sides want to go to the bitter end. Abiy says we should all die defending Ethiopia. This is what he calls Ethiopia. Basically, Ethiopia means his government. And the Tigrayans don't say anything, but it is clear that they want to go till they win. So the question is, how will their victory take shape? The shuttle diplomacy, I'm sorry, is not very useful.
Any prospects for peace? Because the African Union has been calling for dialogue. Do you see Abiy listening to them or the TPLF listening to them?
The TPLF will not listen, that's for sure, because their people are starving and they want to blow this government off the ground and have revenge and also bring food to their people. Abiy could tactically say that he's ready to negotiate.
That's Professor Gerard Prunier, historian and expert on the Horn of Africa, speaking with VOA's John Tanza from Paris. All schools in 13 African countries will soon all be connected to the Internet, enabling millions of children to have access to digital learning content. That's what telecommunications and money services company Airtel Africa is promising. It's entered into a partnership with the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, to help bridge the digital divide. Reporter Vicky Stark has more.
UNICEF's regional manager for public and private partnerships in Eastern and Southern Africa, Isabel Burchard, says before the COVID-19 pandemic, there was already a learning crisis across the continent.
But with the pandemic, this became really a learning catastrophe, with millions of children losing out on basic reading, writing, and math skills. And this required a shift in our thinking and approaches, and led to the Reimagine Education campaign, calling for world-class digital learning solutions that aim to provide connectivity, devices. And that's where the partnership with Airtel Africa comes in, as the first Pan-African partner coming in with a multi-million dollar commitment.
She says Airtel Africa has committed financial and in-kind contributions of $57 million over 5 years. This will enable free access to online education content.
UNICEF is working in partnership with governments, academia, and curriculum experts on the online learning material. And many national platforms are already up and running, and we're further fine-tuning them to the needs of the students.
Airtel Africa's CEO, Segun Ogunsanya, says his company believes in making a difference in people's lives, and they found a strong partner in UNICEF.
Yes, Airtel Africa PLC is a leading provider of mobile communication services. We also provide mobile money services. We are serving over 120 million customers, and we listed on the London Stock Exchange. We're also listed on the Nigerian Stock Exchange, turnover in excess of $4 billion, and our main purpose is to transform lives.
He says statistics show that a large number of Africans still do not have access to the internet.
A recent study by GSMA, which is the umbrella organization of mobile phone companies in most parts of the world, shows that in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa I'm talking about 19% of Africans don't have access to mobile broadband. 19%, that's almost one-fifth of Africans live in areas where there's no mobile broadband. Let's put that aside. We also have those who have the access, but they can't use the internet. Why are they unable to use? One, they cannot afford the charges, or they can't afford to buy the device. Two, they lack the basic education required to use the digital device. Some are just on the street.
He says through this project, they will primarily be connecting schools to the internet.
If it is required, we're going to be providing mobile devices for the children to access. It doesn't have to be a computer. It could be a computer. It could be a mobile device, whatever is required.
Ogunsanya says internet access is essential for the economic and social well-being of Africa and Africans.
I mean, personally, I believe access to internet is a fundamental human right. No one should be denied access to internet in today's world. Look at what happened last year with COVID. It shows how important access to the internet is. So basically, it's like having access to shelter, having access to food. That's what the internet is now.
The 13 countries that are expected to benefit from this partnership with Airtel Africa are Chad, Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Gabon, Kenya, Madagascar, Malawi, Niger, Nigeria, Rwanda, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia. Ogunsanya says a recent study by the International Telecommunications Union shows that for every 10% increase in mobile broadband penetration, the increase in gross domestic product is 2% in low-income countries. That's welcome news to countries whose economies have declined and suffered mounting unemployment under the stress of the COVID pandemic. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
South Africa's coal industry, the world's fifth largest, employs 90,000 miners and generates 80% of the country's electricity. But the costs of the mammoth mining enterprise are also high, and not just for the climate. Soraya Lee of Reuters has more.
South Africa's coal belt is blanketed in smog and ash and coated with the stench of sulfur. The area east of Johannesburg is among the world's most polluted, according to experts. And poor air quality kills thousands of residents every year. But cleaning up this air would require a crackdown on polluting industries, which are also an economic lifeline for local residents. The town of Emalahleni translates to the place of coal in the Zulu language. It's where Mbali Matabule and her daughter Princess live. Her partner found work in a nearby coal plant, which helped the family out of poverty. But when Princess turned four, she developed asthma and started struggling to breathe.
I get very concerned because I feel like my child won't live for a long time because of these mines. That really worries me. It means any time she could die because of her situation.
In 2019, scientists working for South Africa's government completed a study on the health impacts of pollution from the country's coal industry. The results were never officially published. Reuters reviewed a copy of the study, which showed that 5,000 South Africans die annually in the nation's coal belt because the government has failed to fully enforce its own air quality standards. Bobby Peake is an anti-coal activist.
These power stations do not have the pollution control mechanisms on because they were developed in the old apartheid system. And for during the old apartheid system, they just didn't care about pollution. So these are polluting facilities. They have toxic dump sites that are unlined. They have toxic dump sites where the fly ash that has a whole lot of metals and other contaminants just fly off into neighborhoods of people, and people breathing this very fine ash that sits in your lungs.
South Africa has the world's fifth largest coal industry. It employs 90,000 miners and generates 80% of the country's electricity at a time of soaring unemployment and frequent blackouts. The government has granted waivers from emissions limits to its indebted state power and fuel companies, Eskom and Sasol, since 2015, allowing them to save money. Eskom called these waivers an economic necessity, saying it would cost $20 billion and take 10 to 15 years to fully meet national SO2 standards, leading to prolonged outages in the meantime. Eskom has pitched a $10 billion plan to shut most of its coal-fired plants by 2050 and embrace renewables like wind and solar with financing from wealthy nations, though the country's energy minister has called ditching coal economic suicide. But residents in Emalahleni, like Anna Mozoro, say they're the ones really suffering.
We can't live comfortably because of the dust and coal. The smell from the mine dump comes with the smoke. We're not the ones burning the coal, but we are the ones suffering from the smoke.
That's Sonia Ali of Reuters. In a last-ditch attempt to restart talks with North Korea before his term ends next year, South Korean President Moon Jae-in is calling for a declaration that could eventually end a state of war that has technically lasted since the 1950s. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
South and North Korea are technically still at war, even though the fighting ended six decades ago. But that could all change very soon. It's South Korea's outgoing president, Moon Jae-in, who's leading the call to officially end the conflict. He wants a peace agreement on the Korean Peninsula before his time is up in 2022. First, let's take a look at why the two Koreas are still at war. As the Korean War ground to a halt in 1953, South Korean leaders opposed the idea of a truce that left the peninsula divided. They refused to sign the armistice with military commanders from the North, the UN, and China, so the war was simply put on hold. At this time, in 2018, the idea of ending the war resurfaced most strongly when U.S. President Donald Trump, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and South Korea's Moon came together in a flurry of diplomacy. The two Koreas agreed to declare the war over by the end of that year.
I've been told that Kim Jong-un would like to meet.
And Trump said he'd give the effort his blessing if North Korea agreed to give up its nuclear weapons. But as disagreements over sanctions on Pyongyang and its nuclear weapons dragged on, the talks hit a wall, and so did any discussion of ending the war. So what could potentially change the situation now? Reuters correspondent Josh Smith says the war on hold is seen as a key source of conflict by Moon and others.
This is kind of seen the war and the division of the peninsula as kind of the original sin that's left, tensions high between North Korea and then South Korea and the United States. And so it's seen as a possible first step towards reducing some of those tensions.
In a speech to the United Nations in September, Moon once again raised the idea. South Korea is calling first for a political declaration that the Korean War is over, then a peace treaty that replaces the armistice, and finally the establishment of a broader peace regime.
Basically, where there's a lot of disagreements over things like nuclear weapons or the sanctions that were imposed because of North Korea's nuclear weapons, South Korea sees perhaps a little bit more agreement on, you know, simply all sides saying, you know, let's acknowledge reality. We're not fighting a literal war right now.
But what would actually change on the Korean Peninsula in the case of a peace agreement? North Korean officials have responded to Moon's proposals with interest, but they've called them premature without changing what it claims to be hostile policy and double standards over denuclearization. Meanwhile, some analysts in the United States say that while a peace agreement is certainly possible, it can only be made after North Korea agrees to denuclearization.
Eventually, you know, the idea of a peace treaty is that, according to, you know, folks in South Korea, is that eventually that might, you know, really drastically change some of the military stance here. There might be a reduction in troops, in theory, on all sides. Under the most optimistic scenarios that the South Korean President Moon Jae-in has talked about, you know, that could potentially include things like a rail line that goes from South Korea all the way to Europe, because it can finally connect through North Korea, you know, into Russia and across, kind of thing.
Critics of Moon's proposals also worry that arriving at a peace agreement too soon could undermine U.S. deterrence in the region and potentially embolden North Korea militarily. American officials say they have discussed the potential end of war with their South Korean counterparts, but have not yet committed to a declaration.
That's Gloria Tso of Reuters. Lithuania has started building the first wall in Europe against migrants crossing from Belarus, a towering steel structure topped with razor wire. The European Union accuses Belarus of encouraging migrants to cross into neighboring countries. Lucy Fielder of Reuters reports.
Lithuania has built the first stretches of a steel wall on its border with Belarus since migrants from the Middle East and other areas began entering from Belarus this year. The European Union accuses Belarus of deliberately encouraging the migrants to enter EU states Poland, Lithuania and Latvia via Belarusian territory as a way of putting pressure on the bloc. Belarus has repeatedly denied this, but its president, Alexander Lukashenko, has said his country would no longer stop the migrants, since EU sanctions drain resources. All three EU countries have put stretches of razor wire on the border to stop the migrants. Last week, Lithuania began putting up the first stretches of the 11-foot-high steel fence, topped with razor wire. Virgilijus Raugale is a border guard commander.
It's probably impossible to build a totally impassable obstacle, so I think this barrier too could be overcome. But that would take a long time and we would be able to react.
Lithuania wants to build 300 miles of the wall by September next year, supplemented by coiled razor wire and video surveillance. In August, Lithuania started sending almost all entering migrants back to Belarus. More than 5,600 migrants have been prevented from entering since then, the border guard said. Poland's defense ministry, meanwhile, said on Thursday Belarusian soldiers had threatened to open fire on Polish troops just across the border, in what it called an attempt to escalate a crisis over migrants along their common frontier.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. In other news, tens of millions of Americans who work at companies with 100 or more employees would need to be vaccinated against COVID-19 by January 4th or get tested for the virus weekly. The new requirements are the Biden administration's boldest move yet to persuade reluctant Americans to finally get a vaccine that has been widely available for months or potentially face financial consequences. If successful, administration officials believe it will go a long way towards ending a pandemic that has killed more than 750,000 Americans. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, says companies that fail to comply could face penalties of nearly $14,000 per violation. The requirements will apply to about 84 million workers at medium and large businesses. OSHA left open the possibility of expanding the requirements to smaller businesses. It asked for public comment on whether employers with fewer than 100 employees could handle vaccination or testing programs. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedwafo. A New Zealand research project is looking at ways to produce hydrogen in Antarctica to reduce carbon emissions. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A four-month New Zealand project is investigating whether hydrogen could be generated, used and stored at Scott Base, its Antarctic research facility, to reduce its reliance on carbon-based fuels. Those fuels are currently used for transportation, cooking and heating. A special grade fuel is shipped in on icebreakers. Surplus power from wind turbines at Scott Base could be used to generate green hydrogen for hydrogen fuel cells that produce electricity by combining hydrogen and oxygen atoms. The Hydrogen Initiative is a collaboration between Antarctica New Zealand, a government scientific body, and the University of Canterbury in Christchurch. The project started in August and will finish this month. The project faces some obstacles, including geographic isolation and extreme weather. Antarctica is the coldest, windiest and driest continent. In 1983, a temperature of minus 89.2 degrees was recorded. Brendan Miller, a consultant chemical engineer, says it's an ambitious plan.
We'd like to demonstrate that we can use hydrogen effectively as a energy source to replace fossil fuels. It's a very challenging environment to do it in Antarctica, but actually there are some things going for it because the alternates, like batteries, are quite awkward to use for long-term storage, particularly at very cold temperatures.
New Zealand's work in Antarctica focuses in large part on global warming. Experts have said the world's southernmost continent was very sensitive to rising temperatures, and it also influenced the global climate system. Earlier this year, the New Zealand government said it would spend $200 million to guarantee the future of its scientific hub at Scott Base. Scientific projects in Antarctica are highly collaborative, bringing together researchers from around the world. 29 countries, including Australia, China, and the United States, operate bases in Antarctica. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists say they have detected water and carbon monoxide molecules in what is described as the most massive galaxy in the ancient universe. They say their discovery marks the most distant detection of H2O in a star-forming galaxy and that the newly detected molecules also play an important role in the creation of life as we know it. The galaxy is actually comprised of a large and a smaller galaxy, which may merge in the future, and is located nearly 12.88 billion light-years from Earth. This means the scientists were observing the galaxy as it was 12.88 billion years ago, just about 780 million years after the Big Bang. The researchers using the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array in Chile made their findings after conducting an ultra-high resolution and detailed study of the galaxy's molecular gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo. VOA.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa News. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage and world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington. This is wishing you a great weekend.
This is the voice of America, Washington.